name is J. Lauren Sangster, and welcome to my podcast, Flying Over the Hedge. The name of the podcast is a reference to my newly released book, titled The Girl Who Flew Over the Honeysuckle Hedge, Her Lifelong Journey of Coping and Healing with CPTSD, or Complex Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. I am that girl. In my book, I discuss various traumas, beginning at an early age. I was raw and honest when I wrote, but I also wrote with inspiration, and I discuss various coping and healing methods I have used as I navigate life, to include humor and music. I have decided to discuss generational and childhood trauma because I became passionate about the topic of trauma, since while I did suffer through so many of them, and that provides me with a good amount of experience on the subject. So first I want to talk about what is trauma. Trauma is defined by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, or SAMHSA, developed the three E's of trauma. They are event, experience, and effect. So a trauma event is a scary or dangerous, violent, or life-threatening moment that occurs. The event may happen to the individual, such as myself, or to another person, such as a family member. In my family, I had events, sadly, happened to both me and my other family members. The individual may then experience the event by seeing or hearing about it with their unique perception of the event. This includes emotional, cognitive, and physical responses. With cognitive, for those of you who may not know the term, it's defined by Wikipedia as the mental action or process of acquiring knowledge and understanding through thought, experience, and the senses. So each person may experience a trauma event in a unique and different way based on our knowledge, our individual thinking, our prior experiences, and our senses. Because we are unique in how we each experience a trauma, I have to note that not all events have a traumatic impact on a person. Here's a good example. A firefighter going into a burning building to save another person or a pet will not have the same experience of the event as perhaps a homeowner going into the building, because the firefighter has the training to maneuver through the situation or the experience better than the homeowner. So the impact of the experience will or probably may be less for the firefighter than the homeowner. So the effects of the experience may be long-term consequences on the individual's well-being, mental health, and daily life. Or again, due to our uniqueness, it may not have such an impact. Next, I want to talk about something that I think it's very important to distinguish what a big T trauma is and what a little T trauma is, because little T traumas can be just as impactful on our mental health as big T traumas. So a big T trauma, or a type 1 trauma, is just what I described before when we think of the three E's of trauma: the event, the experience, and the effect. A little T trauma may not be seen as traumatic by society, but it still may have an emotional impact. Little T traumas are things such as job loss, a romantic breakup, bullying, or, and this one really resonates with where I'm going next, chronic criticism. Little T traumas can accumulate over time and lead to mental health issues if they are not addressed. When I think of this, I think of that parent who just won't let up on everything you do, the way you dress, the way you choose to wear your hair. You're constantly criticized for something you're doing. This has impact. Maybe it's a teacher. Maybe it's another kid at school. These little moments that just keep going and going and going. That is chronic criticism, and that leads to, I believe, generational trauma. So what is generational trauma? The AI overview defines generational trauma as the idea that traumatic experiences can impact people beyond those who directly experience them. It affects their children, their grandchildren, and even subsequent generations. It can have profound effects on individuals, families, and communities. I know this, I've seen it, I've experienced it. The theory is that generational trauma is passed down through genes or epigenetics, learned behaviors, and coping mechanisms. Epigenetics is defined, again, by AI Overview, as a study of how environmental factors and behaviors can alter the way genes are expressed without changing the DNA sequence. The important takeaway for me is that epigenetic changes can be passed down through generations and can affect a person's health and risk of disease. We've seen this happen time and again. My parent had this illness. I have this illness. They may have developed this illness from something in their life that was traumatic, some health risk, and it gets passed down to us. Examples of generational trauma are violence within the family and abuse in childhood. Both of these are in my family, but also events such as war or life-threatening illnesses, one of them being COVID. It extends from one generation to the next, beginning as a group experience of traumatic event that causes distress in many ways. So anyone in the group develops psychological or physical symptoms, including PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. The next generation then inherits the trauma and health conditions. One thing about generational trauma is that it can be silent and misunderstood. It can be implied but not clarified from an early age based on how one's parents act in caregiving for the child or the children. Again, I think about chronic criticism and how that gets passed down through generations. So what are the reactions to generational trauma? They may include shame, guilt, anxiety, low self-esteem, and depression. I have experienced all of these based on my childhood experiences. So before we can begin to break the cycle and heal generational trauma, we must understand it. My mother was shot during a domestic dispute with my father when I was 7 years old. It was pretty tough, and I was not told anything about how the shooting happened. I did not believe it was okay to ask questions until 13 years later. I discuss why in my book, but it was only after I sought therapy at age 20. Only then did I feel safe to ask my mother about the event, and more importantly, that I had the right to know about what happened because I was affected by the trauma of her shooting. So we must try to understand generational trauma, but we must do so when it feels safe and okay for us. For me, it took 13 years to feel like I was okay with it, and I had left my parents' home by then. I later learned more about what my father endured as a child. Once I began to understand my father's trauma, it was only then that I could understand how to break the cycle of generational trauma, especially to unlearn learned behaviors and methods of coping, and begin to learn healthier methods of coping. So one of the things that's important to realize is how much has changed for the last few generations. What help was available when my parents were younger? How unhealed trauma was not treated the same way in prior generations? Mental health was not as readily available, and there was a stigma associated with going to therapy. It was as though one carried a big sign around their neck, "I have mental health issues." The fact is, we all have some mental health issue, and here's what I mean. Here are a few statistics about generational trauma. About two-thirds of children experience at least one traumatic event by age 16. That's two-thirds of us in our childhood experienced one traumatic event by age 16. Over 90% of people who seek therapy have experienced at least one traumatic event in their lives. 90% of us have experienced at least one traumatic event. So the impact on our mental health, and 90% of us may be experiencing this, is that we feel anxious, we have difficulty forming and maintaining relationships, and we may have a sense of disconnection from one's cultural or family background. I most definitely felt disconnected from my family background, not just from my family background, but from I'm from Kentucky. I'm from Lexington, Kentucky, born and raised. I did not feel as though I fit in with my family or with the people around me. And I don't mind saying this. I lived, I was popular at school. I was in school programs. I was in school clubs. I was in church. I sang in a choir. And I always felt as though I was living on the edge of the group. I never quite fit into the group. I always knew I was an outsider, or I believed that I was an outsider. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my parents to show how I understand more about them. I wanted to understand why they were how they were in our family, why they could not parent effectively. My parents both grew up in poor, larger families. My father was born in 1934, my mother in 1943. So they were born during the Depression and World War II. I learned in my adulthood that my father experienced severe childhood traumas, as did his siblings. I won't go into the traumas because that's his story, but what my father experienced greatly affected him throughout his life. And because he was greatly affected, his behavior was affected, and he had difficulty in his relationships, including with my mother and with his children. My mother experienced a good deal of her trauma. After she married my father, she was a young bride at age 16 and had three children by age 20, with me being her third and youngest child. I know there was some kind of trauma experience in my mother's family. Again, I won't go into them. I will say they greatly affected my mother from her early 20s on. So both parents had trauma with their families as they were growing up. My mother experienced traumas because of her marriage to my father and as a result of traumas that happened with her siblings. My siblings and I then inherited learned behaviors and emotional coping or not coping from both parents. Melanie English has her PhD as a clinical psychologist and parenting evaluator. In Health Magazine, she writes, "We know that intergenerational trauma can mask itself through learned behaviors, beliefs, and patterns that become ingrained. This kind of wiring impacts personalities, relationships, parenting, communication, and views of the world." So generational trauma impacts everything, not just in our immediate family, but our entire view of the world. Our entire perspective is changed. Next, I want to talk about what is child trauma and ACEs, A-C-E. Child trauma happens between the ages of 0 and 18. It's the same definition of trauma I previously provided. It happens prior to one is considered an adult. So both of my parents experienced child trauma and then had three children, again, me being the youngest, who in turn experienced child trauma as a result of our parents' issues from their own trauma. Did you get all that? ACEs are adverse childhood experiences. According to the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, the ACE study is an ongoing research study exploring how childhood experiences may affect long-term health and social consequences. Roughly 65% of children experience one ACE during childhood. 40% experience at least two or more ACEs. I write about four ACEs I had by age 15 to include my mother's shooting. The greater number of adverse childhood experiences, the greater the risk to develop physical and mental health problems throughout life. If you think I wasn't scared when I read these statistics years ago, think again. It absolutely terrified me. Again, adverse childhood experiences may include physical, sexual, or emotional abuse, physical or emotional neglect, your mother being treated violently, a household substance abuse, someone in your household with mental health, and/or a member of the household may be in prison. Here, I must say that neither of my parents went to prison after my mother's shooting or after another adverse childhood experience I write about in my book. And to find out why, you will have to read my book, The Girl Who Flew Over the Honeysuckle Hedge. The National Child Traumatic Stress Network, their webpage is nctsn.org, has a diagram to help family members understand traumatic stress symptoms by a child's age. I'm going to list some of the stress symptoms I went through according to preschool, elementary school, and middle and high school. So in preschool, I felt helpless and uncertain. I had a fear of being separated from my parents. I developed new fears, and I had nightmares. This due to adverse childhood experiences that I had by age 5. I also had another adverse childhood experience at age 7. This is the one where my mother was shot. I had another one at age 12 and another one at age 15. In elementary school, I was anxious and fearful. I worried about my own safety and the safety of others around me. I felt guilt and shame. Mostly the shame was how my family seemed to think about themselves or treat themselves, each other, and me. I had difficulty concentrating, which meant that I had to study to get good grades. I had fears that certain events would happen again. For me, at age 12, I experienced another severe family trauma event, and it caused me to feel very angry within my family. I just couldn't understand how my parents could keep trying to hurt each other the way that they did. An interesting note is that for me, the youngest of 3 girls, I was driven by my anger to get better grades and with a desire to succeed to be able to leave my family. So by age 12, I was already thinking how much I wanted to leave. By age 15, I said to my parents, I want a job, and I knew that I would be saving to leave my family and begin to dissociate with them. By middle school, I felt different from everyone else. I had more sleep disturbances, and my change in behavior was that I needed everything to be perfect, including me. So if my weight had to be a certain way, my appearance had to be a certain way, everything around me, my room had to be perfect, I had a great need for perfection. I didn't want to make a mistake in any way. With 4 ACEs by age 15, the chance that I would have difficulty with relationships, that I would experience moments of low self-esteem and anxiety, that I would feel shame and guilt and have difficulty concentrating, and that I would need therapy were high. I experienced all of this and more. So how do we further heal generational trauma and childhood traumas? So I have healed a good deal of my generational trauma, to include my childhood traumas and the severe traumas I experienced in my 30s. I will mention the trauma in my 30s in a moment, but how did I begin to heal from my trauma experiences, really heal? I used a teaching technique by the Vietnamese Buddhist monk and peace activist Thich Nhat Hanh. I'd read a transcription from a Dharma talk offered at a retreat on Buddhist psychology in Key West, Florida in 1997, where he has this person envision for the first time their 5-year-old self being vulnerable and fragile. And then he has the person provide compassion and love for that innocent, fragile child. He then has the person envision his parents as 5-year-olds, vulnerable and fragile. How could he then not provide compassion and love to the innocent and fragile child that his parents were at that age? This resonated quite strongly with me. I decided to envision my parents as children at maybe 4 or 5 years old, how they were treated, the learned behaviors they were taking on, the emotional responses they were learning, and how in many ways these behaviors were accepted as the norm back then. And it wasn't considered necessary to seek mental health treatment. I began to accept how societal thinking was versus how different it was for me as I grew up with the age of technology and how that provided better research and resources for study. If I'm a compassionate and understanding human being, and I do try very hard to be, then I must be compassionate and understanding toward my parents. They didn't know that how they were acting toward themselves, each other, and their children would so drastically affect us. They simply didn't get it. But I began to. And then once I began to, the responsibility fell to me to help myself to begin to make the changes, to learn to self-govern my emotions. I wrote letters to my parents, and I addressed them as the fragile and vulnerable children they once were, when they were hurt. I expressed compassion and understanding towards them. This helped me to express compassion and understanding for their adult selves as well. As a note, I wrote letters to my younger parts, and I include them in my book. I also had to accept the traumas I experienced in my mid-30s, which included being held captive and tortured in the French Alps, and especially what I had to do to survive. Yeah, you heard that correctly. I was held captive and tortured in the French Alps, and I had to do certain things to survive that took me a long time to accept. I had to put the past experiences behind me. I couldn't do that without therapeutic guidance, without using coping tools that we all have within us, and I practiced using them over and over. It takes time. I had to recognize triggers and the signs and symptoms of those triggers and begin to understand how they relate to the individual or the combined traumas. I chose to stay away from environments that worsen the triggering of the traumas. For me, that was setting boundaries with my family and anyone that I experienced negatively. It also meant I stayed away from certain television shows and movies and what music I listened to. I, of course, went to talk therapy for years, but I also tried other kinds of therapy, and I will talk about this in a later episode. So what's it like for a non-trauma mind to communicate with a trauma mind or someone who has experienced a lot of trauma, even though I have healed a great deal? Joining me today is my partner, John. As John and I have gotten to know each other, there's been a distinct difference in how we as a couple communicate. John did not grow up with trauma. I, as you are aware, did. Hi, John.
Hi, Lauren.
So, when we communicate, we are coming into the conversation from our individual life perspective. You come in thinking with a mind that has not experienced a great deal of trauma, well, at least not until the last few years, and I'm not talking about since we met, but you had your own individual traumas before we met, and even as we met, you were experiencing some of those traumas. I came into the relationship with a mind that has experienced several severe traumas, and while I've healed a good deal, as I say, I can still at times have certain triggers and experience our communication differently from you. What does this feel like for you, John?
Well, when we first met, I think it was a little bit more awkward than it is now because I'm learning more about trauma and how it affects people, and more importantly, how it affected you and how it affects our communication. So initially it was a little bit, there were times I think maybe unnerving, definitely uncomfortable. I didn't know what I had said to make you uncomfortable. And it took a while for us to work through some serious communication about what was going on and have me feel like it wasn't, or understand that it wasn't my fault and that it was things that you were working through. And over time, it has obviously not been a problem and something that's gotten much better.
Well put. I will add that we went through a little bit of couples therapy, and we did this specifically to learn how to communicate better together, both with your non-trauma mind and with my trauma mind. And so here's an example of a very simple moment, a simple experience that we both had together last week. And this is how it went. We were on a trail walk in fairly open woods on a cut grass path. The path began to disappear. It wasn't marked well at all. You really only saw the path as it was cut through the woods, and there was some high grass around where the path was cut. So we were then walking more in tall grass as the path ended. And as we stepped out of the cut grass path and I was following you, a few thoughts went on in my head. First of all, John is a wildlife biologist. You have been in the woods a lot and you know environments. Logically, I know I'm safe with you. I grew up taught to be afraid of snakes. I know we're in an area with dangerous snakes. We're walking in tall grass now. I'm scared, but I should trust John. I don't like feeling lost. And the more we walked, even though it was mainly open and we could see around us, I experienced a trigger from when I was held in the forest of the French Alps. I was held deep in the forest. There was no other home for several miles around. The forests were very dense, and I felt lost the entire time I was there. And the experience I write about in my book, it is understandable why I do not like to feel like I am off a safe path. So I experienced the trigger that caused me to think of the French Alps. Logically, I told myself, I'm here in the present. I'm safe. I'm with someone I know I can trust. My mind was triggered even though I looked around me and I experienced fear and panic. I wanted to turn back. I also did not want to upset you because I should trust you. I love you. And I know how experienced you are. So I was at battle with myself, the logical me, the panic me, the wanting to please you, the wanting to take care of myself. All of this came up for me. So what was your experience of the moment?
Well, as we're walking through, it was a piece of woods that had been impacted by the last couple hurricanes that hit this area, and there were some blown down trees, and the path that had previously been regularly mowed was growing up to tall grasses. So as we're walking along, I could see where the path was clearly just based on the difference in vegetation. And even though the grass was getting high, I knew where it was. And we had looked at a map and saw that it looped around. And so I sensed that you were getting a little bit uncomfortable. And when that happened, I figured, well, let's get out of here. We either go back, and I suggested we go back the way we came, or we continue on the loop, which was I think going to be the quicker way out, but because it hadn't been mowed in some time, it wasn't, really clear. And like you said, I had spent most of my life out in the woods, and we weren't that far from the road. So I figured, well, we either turn around and we keep going. And I knew you were getting uncomfortable, and I wanted to get out of there the fastest way. And at one point, I thought the fastest way was going to be just to backtrack because it wasn't clear. Really clear where the path was.
And so with that, I'm going to say, what did I say when you suggested we turn around?
I can't remember.
I said, no, let's just keep going. And right. Because I was trying to fight, my logical mind was trying, but I said it in a very frustrated way, if you remember, because my logical mind was trying to fight the triggered part of me. And I wanted to overcome and endure it and just get through it. You suggested a second time I said, John, I am not happy with this. This is upsetting me. I need to get out of here. I need to get back on the path. I started actually becoming so anxious. My breathing was getting heavy. I was going into a panic mode, even though I was looking around me and I could see we were in open air. It wasn't dark. It was light. I was there with someone I knew I could trust, but I wanted to force myself through the situation. Eventually, John had to say, let's just turn around, and you had to make it happen for us to go back and retrace our steps. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I remember it quite well. And I knew you were getting definitely anxious. And, you know, at that point in time, turning around was going to be the quickest way to get us back. And so that's what we did.
And beautifully, John remained calm. He told me I was doing fine. And we retraced our steps. As soon as I saw the cut grass path ahead of us, I calmed down and I went up beside John on the path. I held his hand and I said, I'm not too fond of you at the moment. because I felt as though I'd been led in a situation. And yet I think I was talking more to myself, if I'm honest. So after we were back on the path, John said something to me that again triggered me a little bit. He said that he felt bad when he pushed my limits sometime. I'll tell you what I heard in the moment. What I heard with my mind was you were pushing me to go beyond my comfort zone of being in the woods and experiencing feeling lost. I thought, okay, I get he's trying to help me get through this kind of experience better, but I push me, and I know when my limit is reached, and I had reached my limit in this particular type of situation. So what did you mean when you said you felt bad for pushing my limit sometime?
I thought I was asking you to go too fast when we were trying to get out of there, so... There was a little bit of a miscommunication there.
I laugh because it's such a simple explanation, and my mind went this whole other area with it. So a few days later, about 2 days later, I said to John I wanted to talk about that moment. And it took me really 2 days. I was going to be fine talking about it, but if something's keeps bothering me, then I think, okay, I should sit down and have a conversation with John that, you know, to let him know he doesn't need to push me because I push myself far enough and I know how far I can be pushed or should be pushed. In this situation, I was trying to push myself, forcing myself to keep going on the path when a part of me was clearly triggered and I needed to turn back. I just needed to get to a sure path that I could see. So I wanted to talk to John about what that comment meant and how I took it. Do you remember that conversation when I brought it up to you, how that went?
Yeah, I remember when you brought it up. I can't remember exactly how it went.
Since that conversation, John and I have both done some reading about how the trauma mind experiences these kind of moments versus how the non-trauma mind experiences them. One of the key points for me is that I know how difficult it is for me to communicate clearly what I mean or sometimes what I need when I've been triggered or my trauma mind has been triggered. My mind can feel somewhat jumbled, and I know it's due to the emotional upheaval I experience in these particular moments, especially when I'm fighting. I'm fighting the trigger with my logical mind. And my triggered mind is still being upset. I could not regulate in that moment. So in the moment you suggested we turn back, I had those mixed feelings. And all I knew was that I wanted out of it. And I wasn't sure how to get out of it. So how do you believe things might go as we move forward and I will inevitably experience another trigger moment where I am unable to effectively clarify my real needs to you?
Well, like I said, I think our relationship has been, our communication during our relationship is getting better and better and clearer and clearer the more that we each understand where we're coming from. And I'm patient, and I know that you're patient with me, and I think that makes a big difference because it allows us flexibility to work through some of these challenges. And from my standpoint, I'm very understanding of it, and I get it. And understanding and makes everything clearer, if that makes sense. It gives you more flexibility to you know, get through some of the uncomfortable parts. And you just, I, because I love you so much, I don't have a problem doing that.
And I love you so much too. So thank you. Before we wrap up, I'm going to segue into another type of trauma. And this will lead into my next episode. I'm going to talk about post-traumatic caregiving. Caregiving is a role that can happen to any of us at any time. Many are often thrown into the role of caregiving after receiving the trauma shock of learning, as John and I did, that our spouse is ill in some way. For us, it was that our spouses had terminal cancer. Caregiving is a fast-moving role, and there are so many curves thrown at you. It's a waterfall effect of critical moments, and the learning curves are constant and sharp. Many begin to experience post-traumatic caregiving, especially after the caregiving process is over. It can begin to subside for many after the caregiving is over, but for many, it may lead to post-traumatic stress disorder. The point is, while you are in a state of post-traumatic caregiving, you may experience unwanted, upsetting memories or flashbacks, nightmares, emotional distress after exposure to traumatic reminders, or you may feel disconnected or withdrawn. I experienced all of these effects. Also for me, while my husband, Mike, was ill, I had a major event take place. I stopped speaking to my father. I wrote him a letter to explain why I was no longer going to have contact with him, and I told him I did not have the capacity to hold space for him. I was so immensely drained. John, would you like to share what it felt like for you during caregiving and after?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you find out that your spouse is, you know, sick, it's bad. When you find out that your spouse has a terminal illness, it's brutal. We all know we're going to die, but, you know, you hope that the time isn't right in front of you. And when you confront a terminal illness, you realize that that timeline is finite, and it's right in your face and then right in front of you. And it's, you know, all of us are going to die. But it's something that you have to deal with and deal with sooner than you thought you were going to. And it can be overwhelming. Obviously, when you have a lot of support, it helps. But really, the relationship is most finite between, you know, your spouse and yourself. And you're you sit around looking at one another, realizing that the end is near, and it's hard. It's incredibly hard. It's probably the hardest thing or one of the hardest things you're ever going to have to deal with. That was challenging. I had a good support group. I can say that it was the most stressful period of my life ever, and it was incredibly challenging. And you do the best you can. And I think, I know I'm proud of how well we handled it. We did the best we could. Could we have done better? Yeah, for sure. But those are the types of things that I think you only look back in hindsight. While you're in the midst of it, you're juggling all these balls
Yeah, those are those curves, those sharp curves that come up, you know, unexpectedly, yeah. And you just got to maneuver through everything so fast. So I get that.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that you'd like to do a bunch of times before you actually have to do it, but you don't get that chance, you know. You get that chance when it's thrown at you.
Thank you, John. So I write in my book, as I say, I use music and humor. I write about many of the ways I use both music and humor in coping, and I have used both of these throughout my life. I'm going to mention one song that I played every, it took me 1 year of writing every single day to write my book and to write my story. And it was a difficult story to write. But don't worry, there is a lot of humor. There are some charming stories within the book. And there's a lot of songs if you want to learn the songs from the early 60s until today. Tracy Chapman. Oh, man, do I love her. And did she get me through some really tough years, especially after my husband passed away? Her song just resonated with how I was feeling, and especially when I decided to write my book. I knew that I had to tell it like it is. And Tracy Chapman's song, Tell It Like It Is, if you don't know it and you want to know what really, really pushed me forward, go listen to her song, Tell It Like It Is. It just resonated so strongly with me. So I love kid jokes. I write several of them in my book. It's ways that I kind of lift the moment and I get up and out of myself. And the sillier, the better. You might put your head in your palm when you hear this one, but I like it anyway. What do you call an angry carrot? You call it a steamed veggie. I can't help it. It's silly, but I love it. And I hope that you will get the lightheartedness and why I choose to tell these jokes. With that short introduction to post-traumatic caregiving, please tune in for my next podcast topic, parental and/or family estrangement. I will be talking about family estrangement because I wrote about it in my book, The Girl Who Flew Over the Honeysuckle Hedge. John, we will continue with a little more discussion about post-traumatic caregiving, and then we will segue into parental and/or family estrangement as we discuss the subject from both perspectives. The one choosing to be estranged, that's me, and the one who has been estranged by a family member, that's you. This will be interesting, and it will be educational for many today, because some 27% of us are currently estranged from one or more family members. I find that number staggering. It's something that I did not know about until I got to know John and we started talking more about family estrangement. As a last, for anyone who has experienced or is experiencing trauma, and if I am to believe the statistic that 90% of those seeking therapy have experienced at least one trauma, please know that you're not alone. You are not helpless. We can join support groups, get financial help, make spiritual connections, or go to therapy. All of this is a means to heal. I want to say I understand that accessing mental health care may be difficult, more difficult for many racial and ethnic minorities affected by generational trauma or any trauma. Because of this, people may be less likely to get proper treatment, or if they seek to get treatment, do not receive the same quality of health care. A mental health provider should be competent in your cultural and social needs. On that note, I have provided a few resources from Health Magazine for various cultural groups that may help you find a mental health professional. These resources are listed on my website at flyingoverthehedge.com. I provide these websites because understanding trauma shouldn't cost you anything but time. Thanks for listening to Flying Over the Hedge with your host, that's me, J. Lauren Sangster, author of the newly released book titled The Girl Who Flew Over the Honeysuckle Hedge, Her Lifelong Journey of Coping and Healing with CPTSD. Remember, I am not a mental health professional, but I am someone who has experienced a significant amount of trauma, who is discussing my experiences, the effects of those experiences, coping methods, and healing. If you or someone you know has experienced trauma and you are having difficulty coping, I encourage you to seek help with a mental health professional. My call to action is practice self-compassion. What does that mean? It means responding to yourself with understanding and kindness, especially when you make a mistake, and we all make mistakes. Again, For more information, including a page of websites I mentioned during my podcast, please visit flyingoverthehedge.com. Remember to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Thank you.
Produced by Autovita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.